This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Bored of too many ads and dull, meaningless chat? We've got neither. Joy Drive, smart, fun radio.
If any of the following conversation causes any distress or raises any issues for you, please head to joy.org.au/support or call 1-800-RESPECT. After a national cabinet meeting on Wednesday, Anthony Albanese has announced $925 million to help victims of violence leave abusive relationships and a ban on deep fake pornography. And the measures are aimed to combat violence against women. But will it make a difference, and is it enough? Dr. Jess Ison is a researcher at the Reducing Gender-Based Violence Research Group at La Trobe Rural Health School. Jess, welcome to Joy Drive.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you think of the Prime Minister's announcement?
Look, I think it seems like a lot of money when we see it on face value. $1 billion sounds like a lot. But when we start to look a bit more closely, one of the main things that's happening is funding for women who are leaving abusive relationships of up to $5,000. This is from the Morrison era, this project, and has some considerable issues, but also the fact that the main commitment here is for $5,000 only in this cost of living crisis. It doesn't take you very far. What happens once that $5,000 very quickly runs out, and the woman and her children or pets don't have stable housing? It's not nearly enough.
The other thing that struck me is it's not also addressing what we need to do, and what do we need to do to prevent gender-based violence in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. Look, there's no simple answer, of course. But in Australia, we have a national plan called the National Plan to End Violence Against Women and Children. Mm-hmm. And that has four elements. That is prevention, as you mentioned, early intervention, response and recovery. And so to really address this issue, we need to be sustained funding across all four areas in order to tackle what is such a mammoth issue. There's no simple or quick fix. It needs to be addressed from all angles and at the same time. And often what we see in moments like this is governments doing kind of knee-jerk responses where they pour a lot of funding in one or two, in this instance, two places, and we don't see that commitment across the board. And that's really what we need and what we need to be pressure on the government for.
And clearly gender-based violence is not a new phenomenon that's occurring. What have governments done in the past, and why you know, are we only talking about it now?
Look, I don't think we are only talking about it now. It's more that we get cycles in the media and in advocacy where this gets taken up. And, you know, so much of that is because of the amazing work of victim survivors to bring attention to this issue. And they're doing a great job. And so we see kind of coverage and it gets talked about. And really that's been since the women's movement in the 70s as well, really strong focus on this issue. The problem is that the government doesn't then take that to do a sustained response. It just does those quick responses. And you know, also as well, we've been doing increasing advocacy around this in LGBTQ communities. You know, we can talk about that more, but we've seen some really great work coming out of our communities to address this issue.
And how prevalent is gender-based sexual violence in the community and also within the LGBTQ+ family violence area as well?
Yeah, look, the prevalence is always really hard to know because a lot of it comes from police data and lots of people don't report, particularly marginalised communities, Indigenous communities, LGBTQ communities. We don't report because we don't trust the police because of historic and ongoing police violence. And so often police reported data is really at the low end of what the prevalence rates are. And that's similarly in LGBTQ communities. It's very hard to know what the rates are. There's very kind of limited research or research often in this area will kind of collapse us all together. So a lot of the research just says sexual minority people have higher rates. But then when you break it down and look at different groups, I think that's the more important and more, what we need to be looking at. Not to say that there's not importance of at times looking at us as a whole community, but also we need to be breaking down and looking at different rates within our communities and why and how that's happening.
We're chatting with Dr. Jess Ison, researcher at the Reducing Gender-Based Violence Research Group at the La Trobe Rural Health School, about combating violence against women. Are there any differences in the rate of gender-based violence between rural and urban settings?
Again, it's really hard with the prevalence because of underreporting. We do see particularly high rates of reported family violence in rural and remote communities. But we also need to be cautious that, for example, certain communities, for example, low socioeconomic communities are often more heavily policed and so will have high reported police rates for a range of reasons, including that more heavily policed. That being said, there are really specific issues that rural and remote communities face. For example, they have very limited services. For example, sexual violence victims, survivors here in Victoria, if they live in rural and remote communities, might really struggle often if there even is a specific sexual assault service, for example, at a hospital. If a victim does go to a hospital, many don't, but say they do, the person often is only in working till 11 p.m. So if you go in after 11:01, there won't be anyone there to assist you. You might have to travel to Metro Melbourne, and I imagine that's pretty similar across Australia. So it's very difficult for regional and rural communities to access services. And then if you add on top of that, for example, being LGBTQ, you might have one family violence worker who's LGBTQ specific in an entire regional area, and you might know that person as a friend. They might be an ex-lover. They might, you might not want to talk to them. So there's really big barriers for services.
Is the criminal justice system's response, I suppose, what would you like to see change there in terms of, I suppose, deterring those that do offend and also protecting survivors?
Look, the criminal justice system for victim survivors is re-traumatising at every stage. It negatively impacts victim survivors at every point, from reporting to the police, who often might not believe them. We also see a really big problem with misidentification, which means that the victim is misidentified by the police officer as the perpetrator. We see that particularly with marginalised women, such as Indigenous women. Mm-hmm. And then at every stage throughout the process, victim survivors are disbelieved, are treated very poorly in the criminal justice system. I talk to a lot of victim survivors in my work, and they really talk about the criminal justice system being a second trauma that they experience if they do go through the criminal justice system. There's really considerable issues. I don't think that it acts as a deterrent. I think what we need, instead of more policing or more prisons, is we need community responses where we work within our communities, and we work to change this at a structural level and at a community level, rather than focusing on more criminal justice responses.
Jess, we had a really good chat yesterday. It was to an organisation called DV Safe Phone, and that's repurposing unwanted smartphones as emergency phones for survivors of domestic violence. And for those who are interested, that website is dvsafephone.org. What else can we all do to help reduce the incidence of gender-based violence?
Yeah, look, I think what we want is to really be pushing that this is being addressed at a national level, and pushing our government to be doing this. I think all of us, of course, individually can be doing things like within our community, within our queer community. I think we do address these issues. We talk about these issues, and we work to support victims who need help, who need support accessing services. We're really good at pushing the services that we do have in our communities to serve to serve us for what we need. And so I think there is things we can do, but what we really want to be focusing on is pushing that the government's doing something at that structural level and is doing something that's sustained, not just these knee-jerk responses, so that we can see actually large-scale change.
Jess, it's a really important conversation, and we appreciate your time for and taking the time to chat with us today on Joy Drive. Thank you so much. That is Dr. Jess Ison, researcher at the Reducing Gender-Based Violence Research Group at La Trobe Rural Health School. Don't forget, if any of that conversation has raised any issues for you, please head to joy.org.au/support or call 1-800-RESPECT.
Joy Drive on Joy 94.9 FM in Melbourne, Joy on your digital radio, iHeartRadio, TuneIn.com or the Joy app, no matter where you are.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.